So we've now gotten down to causes and conditions. And as I look at this inventory, I realize that this is about all the inventory I need. For people like me, this inventory is just exactly right. You know, as I look back in my lifetime, I cannot spot an emotional problem that didn't revolve around just one of two or three different things. I was always madder than hell at something or somebody. I was always scared to death about something. Or I'd done something I shouldn't have done, and guilt and remorse was eating me up. And as I project into the future, I don't see anything coming up that won't revolve around those three things.
That's right.
There's nothing new. There's nothing new. Time changes, places changes, years changes, hell, people stay the same. You know? We're today just like they were in the 1930s. And this kind of inventory really, really is a pretty good inventory. Now, I don't know whether you all have noticed or not, but if you ever noticed that nearly all the information in the big book on sex is on page 69?
Yeah, we noticed that.
I don't know that it means anything at all. It just happens to be where most of it is. We heard a story about a young lady in AA who had been in about 90 days, and she went to her sponsor and said, "Sponsor, I got a problem." And her sponsor said, "Well, what is it?" And she said, "Well, it's a sex thing." She said, "Sober, I don't really know what to do." She said, "Anything I've ever done in the sexual area, tried to attract a member of the opposite sex or anything else, has always been while drinking." And she said, "Sober, I just don't know how to function in that area." The sponsor said, "Well, I suggest you go home, get out your book, your big book, read page 69, and it'll answer any questions you might have." So the young lady went home, got her book out, proceeded to read, but she got mixed up on page numbers. Instead of page 69, she read page 96. Just for the hell of it, why don't you go to 96 and see what she read? I think it's one of the most appropriate things I've ever read. It just goes on and on and on in two or three different pages. Okay, let's go over now to page 72. We're starting a new chapter now. Chapter 6.
Into action.
Into action. Now, it does not say into thinking. It says into action. Having made our personal inventory, what shall we do about it? We've been trying to get a new attitude, a new relationship with our Creator, and to discover the obstacles in our path.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We have admitted certain defects.
Mm-hmm.
We have ascertained in a rough way what the trouble is. We put our finger on the weak items in our personal inventory. Now, these are about to be cast out. This requires action on our part, which when completed will mean that we've admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our defects. This brings us to the fifth step in the program of recovery mentioned in the preceding chapter. Now, again, we've got to look at a couple of words. We know that step 5 says we admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. But you'll notice here in the narrative on step 5, he says the exact nature of our defects. He uses one word in the step, but a different word in the narrative. And people used to ask Bill about this. They'd say, "Bill, why did you use the word wrong in step 5? And the word defects in the narrative on it? And by the way, Bill, what is the difference between a wrong in 5, a defect in 6, and a shortcoming in 7? Now, Joe and I have known two ladies that worked with and for Bill for years. They both tell us the same thing, that people would ask Bill those questions, and he would just kind of rear back and smile and say, "Well, when I took English and writing courses in college, They taught me not to use the same words over and over, because that shows how dumb you really are. He said, there's no difference in these things. He said, in step four, we're going to find those things that block us off from God. In step five, we're going to talk about them to another human being. In step six, we're going to become willing to turn them loose. And in step seven, we're going to ask God to take them away. And he said, you can call them anything you want to. A wrong, a fault, a mistake, a defect, a shortcoming, a personality flaw, or whatever you wish. And we're going to see on the next two pages that's exactly what he does. Playing these words back and forth, paying no attention to where they fall. I followed it up into the 12 and 12. And 13 years later, he did the same thing there, only even worse. He just plays these words back and forth, mixing them up in these particular three steps. So we're convinced that in Bill's mind, they were all the same thing. Now he said, this is perhaps difficult.
Okay. Especially discussing our defects with another person. He uses that word again. You mentioned it doesn't say wrongs. He says defects. We think we have done well enough in admitting these things to ourselves. There is little doubt about that. In actual practice, we usually find a self-interior appraisal, self-appraisal insufficient. Many of us thought it necessary to go much further. We will become reconciled in discussing ourselves with another person when we see a good reason why we should do so. The best reason first. If we skip this vital step, we may not overcome drinking, and that's good enough reason for taking this step. Okay, time after time, newcomers have tried to keep to themselves certain facts about their lives, trying to avoid this humbling experience. They have turned to easier methods. Almost invariably, they got drunk. Having observed with the rest of the program, they wondered why they failed. We think the reason is they never completed their house cleaning. They took inventory all right, but they hung on to some of the worst items in stock because they really didn't see it. They only thought they had lost their egotism and fear. They only thought they had humbled themselves, but they had not learned. They didn't get the information. Enough of humility and fearlessness and honesty in the sense we find it necessary until we told someone else all their life story. This is the only way to gather that information.
Now that little statement, all their life story, that's the statement that confused us in step four in the beginning. We didn't know how to do four, so we read that statement on page 73 in step five, and we said, oh, that must have been what they wanted us to do then in step four. So we went back to four and started writing our life stories. And as we talked about yesterday, it's easy to see that 95% of my life story really has nothing to do with my alcoholism. But I'll tell you what did. The resentments did, the fears did, and the guilt and remorse did. Now, if I have done the inventory the way the book says, I have done all my life story resentment-wise. You see, my resentments didn't come in my head just today. They've been popping in my head as far back as I can remember. And if I've worked on those resentments, I've done my life story there. My fears didn't come in my head just today. They've been popping in my head as far back as I can remember. If I've done my fears according to the inventory in the book, I've shared all my life story fears-wise. My guilt and remorse didn't come just today. I've been hurting people as far back as I can remember. My mother said to me once, she said, Charlie, you were the meanest kid I ever saw. She said, I had a little trouble loving you myself. You know, when you get so bad that mama don't love you, you got a problem. I've shared all my life story, guilt and fear wise. And really, When you've done your resentments, fears, guilt, and remorse, and people you've harmed, hell, that is your life story. So we don't have any quarrel with that statement today. We've shared our life story. Now, more than most people, the alcoholic leads a double life. He's very much the actor. To the outer world, he presents his stage character. This is the one he likes his fellows to see. He wants to enjoy a certain reputation, but knows in his heart he doesn't deserve it. Way back in the description of alcoholism, it told us we're real Dr. Jekylls and Mr. Hyde. You know, when we're sober, we're living one kind of life. But when we're drinking and that alcohol goes in there and lowers the inhibitions, we live in a different kind of life then. And we certainly don't want people to see it. The inconsistency is made worse by the things he does on his sprees. Coming to his senses, he's revolted at certain episodes he vaguely remembers. These memories are a nightmare. He trembles to think someone might have observed him. As fast as he can, he pushes these memories far inside himself. He hopes they will never see the light of day. He is under constant fear and tension, and that makes for more drinking. Psychologists are inclined to agree with us. We spend thousands of dollars for examinations. We know but few instances where we've given these doctors a fair break. We have seldom told them the whole truth, nor have we followed their advice. Unwilling to be honest with these sympathetic men, we were honest with no one else. You know, let's face it. We alcoholics have become the world's greatest con artist. You have to be. You can't exist as a practicing alcoholic unless you learn how to lie, con, manipulate, cheat, steal if necessary. And I think the one that we've conned the most is ourselves. I don't think we could live with ourselves while drinking if we had to honestly see the truth. But you see, we don't have to see that. We got a little thing called resentments. And we use those resentments to transfer all blame to others and make ourselves as pure as the driven snow. Now, if you've been doing that for the last 5 years, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 years, depending on how long we've been drinking, if you've been doing that, then what makes us think we can be honest when we get here? You know, in step four, we do the absolute best we can. Mm-hmm. But let's face it, I just can't be very honest with me. What I need to do now is take my step four to another human being. One who's walked this walk before me. One who understands 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 according to the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. And let them look at my inventory and show me those things I can't see about myself. You know, that's where I learned a lot of stuff. Now, he's not going to change anything in column one. He's not going to change anything in column two. He's probably going to change some things in column three. You know, in one place there in column three, I said, well, this was caused by the sex instinct. No, he said, you're just trying to build your self-esteem here. He helped me see some things I couldn't see. He's probably not going to change anything in column four. But he's probably going to change some things in column five. One place I said this was caused by fear. He said, oh, no. He said, this is plain damn dishonesty. That's all this is. He helped me see things about me I couldn't see. No human being can honestly see the truth about themselves. We just can't do that. Now, I certainly couldn't do that when I was taking step four and five. I can't even do that today. You know, after 26 years in this fellowship, I amaze me sometimes. You know, you could be sitting there with a $100 bill sticking out of your pocket. I can walk by you and steal that $100 bill. And by the time I get to the back door, I've already figured out a reason that I needed to do that. And by the time I get through the back door, I've already figured out how I've done you a favor by taking your $100 bill. That's how good I am at this stuff. You know, I don't trust me today. I've got a sponsor. That's right. And anything in my life that has any importance whatsoever, I run it by him. And I'm amazed how often he says, Charlie, you're blowing smoke up your rear again. This is not the truth. And really, we just can't do that. Now, I know confession is good for the soul. And if you belong to a religion that requires it, certainly you got to do this. But I also think the real purpose of step five, is to extract every bit of truthful information we can about ourselves from our step forward. You see, we're getting ready to change this stuff now. And if we start trying to change the wrong things and do the wrong things, we're not going to get any better. So we need to see the truth as much as we can. That's one of the real purposes of step five. Another thing I think it does, since we are tri-dimensional creatures, it starts putting us back together in our relationship with God and with our fellow man. The three of us will now be together when we're doing step five. We're doing it with God, ourselves, and another human being. And that's the way we're supposed to live anyhow. Joe?
Okay, on page 74, he begins that this page is multi-design. And remember, the book has been unchanged quite actually since it was printed. And here we have to go back to 1939 when the book was published. And the book was complete. We can see how complete the book was. You know, there wasn't anybody here. And as the book came out, people had to do step five with somebody. This page would tell them how to find someone to do that with. Wasn't any sponsors here. Now we can have sponsors here. Sponsor always, no problem finding somebody. We hope that we can find someone who is familiar with the do step five, who is familiar with the big book inventory. That's the best. And if you all that are here this weekend involved in the inventory, you will be knowledgeable now about the inventory to be able to do step five with other people who are using it.
You guys are going to be the step fivers of the future.
But in those days, they didn't have anybody around. There wasn't any sponsors. So the first new man had to tell him how to do this. He says, rightly and naturally, well, we think before we choose a person or a person with whom we take this intimate and confidential step. Those of us belonging to religious denominations, which require confession, must, and of course, will want to go to the properly appointed authority whose duty is to receive it. Those people belonging to that particular religion can do that. He said, though we have no religious connection, we may still do well to talk to someone ordained and established religion. We often find such people quick to see and understand our problem. And of course, we sometimes encounter people who do not understand the alcoholic. Okay, if we cannot or would not rather do this, we search out acquaintance or close-mouth understanding friend. Now, they had it pretty tough. Can you imagine taking step five with a close friend? You know, that's pretty going to work. Say, hey, man, can I take step five with you? That's pretty tough. They had a hard time. Perhaps our doctor or psychologist. Now, you know, he's running out of good people now. Now, it even gets worse. It may be one of your own family. See, they had a hard time doing this.
You think he's scraping the bottom of the bucket?
Yeah, he's scraping the bottom of the bucket now. So, we got plenty of knowledgeable people around, people that can gladly do this today. We don't have, but the book had to take in consideration how they could do this. Oh, on page 75, when we got the person, he said, when you decided who is to hear our story, we waste no time. We have a written inventory. We've got all this information. We are prepared for a long talk. We explain to our partner what we're about to do and why we have to do it. He should realize that we are engaged upon a life and death errand. Most people approaching this way will be glad to help. They will be honored by our confidence. We pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Now we have some personality change after this step, or some promises, or whatever we want to look at them. Once we have taken this step but holding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us and we begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs. We came to believe at step two. But now we begin to have a spiritual experience.
You see, we don't have to wait till step 12 to get something out of this. The personality change
sufficient
is taking place as we work through the steps.
Spiritual experience, a personality change sufficient to recover is taking place. That the feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly after step 5. We'll feel we're on a broad highway walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. So we get take that second step of action, and we get that second groups of personality changes taking place. And then we have a little pause after step 5. It gives us a little rest stop. Said, returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour.
Now, he didn't say 72 days. 1 hour.
Okay. Carefully reviewing what we have done. We thank God from the bottom of our heart. We know him better. We don't know God, but we know him better than when we started. Taking this book down from our shelf, we turn the page which contains the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first 5 proposals, we ask if we have omitted anything, for we are building an arch to which we shall walk a free man at last. Is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement putting the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? And again, he comes back to the little picture he's been painting since chapter one. When he said one, when he said step one, wilderness was the foundation. And he said on that foundation we put a cornerstone of believing. And we didn't even know what we were building. We just had the foundation and the cornerstone. When he got to step 3, he told us we were building an arch. And step 3 was the keystone in that arch. And now after he goes back after 5, he says, after we go finish step 5, let's go back and review it. Put in 2 more stones. We got 4 and 5 in. See if they are intact. Are the stones properly in place? We're building this arch through which we're going to walk to freedom. The personality change is working. And he said, if we can answer yes is our satisfaction, then we can look at step 6. If our work is intact, then we can look at the next step.
I hope that the same thing will happen to you at the end of step 5 that happened to me. When I took step 4 and looked at all that stuff, you know, I still wasn't really sure about some of those things. When I took step 5 with another human being, and he pointed out to me some things I didn't know, some things I didn't understand, when he verified for me that some of the things I had in there was right, and when he helped correct some of the things that were wrong, as I finished up step 5, for the first time in my life, I could see where I needed to be going. See, I see in step 4 and 5 what I have become. And now then, I can see what I need to become in the future. And I can see the things I need to change and hopefully become a different human being. And you can't see those things without step 4 and 5. And now then, I have a sense of direction and I can see where I'm trying to go. On page 76, if we can answer to our satisfaction, we then look at step 6. We have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things which we have admitted are objectionable? Can he now take them all, every one? If we still cling to something we'll not let go, we ask God to help us be willing. And that's all of step 6, that little paragraph. And if you'll notice, he didn't say anything about defects of character in there. He said those things which we have admitted are objectionable. Now surely, as we filled out those inventory sheets, and we kept looking over into that 5th column, and we kept seeing the old selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened, inconsiderate character that we had become, when we could see that those are what caused the resentments and the fears and the guilt and the remorse, when we could see that if we stay that way, we're not ever going to change, and we're going to keep right on having the same old problems, Surely that type of character has become objectionable to us by now. Are we ready to turn loose of that selfishness? Are we ready to let go of that dishonesty? Are we ready to turn loose of fear? Are we ready to turn loose of inconsideration? If we are, we've already done step six. But the book recognizes now that self cannot overcome self. In every action step, there's some prayer. He says, if we still cling to something we will not let go, we ask God to help us be willing. You know, it looks like that by now we would just be tickled to death to get rid of those things. But sometimes we would rather sit in today's pain and suffering because we've kind of learned how to take care of that. We would rather sit in today's pain and suffering than take a chance on changing in the future because we don't know what change is going to bring. You know, if I'm going to have to turn loose of my selfishness, then how am I going to get what I want in the future? If I'm going to have to turn loose of my dishonesty, how am I going to make a living? I don't know anything about honesty. Christ, I've been dishonest all my life. How am I going to make a living in the future if I've got to be honest? If I'm going to have to turn loose of my fear, that means I'm going to have to live on courage, and I don't know anything about living on courage. I've always run on fear. If I'm going to have to start considering other people, then who's going to take care of me? You know, let's face it. Sometimes it's hard to turn this stuff loose. And the book says if we're not ready, we ask God to help us be willing to do so. And the willingness will come. When ready, we say something like this. My Creator, I'm now willing you should have all me good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character. Whoop, we're in step seven now. And step seven said shortcomings, and here he says defects of character. See what he's done to us? He's confused the hell out of us is what he's done. He just plays these words back and forth. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. With you we will. We've then completed step seven. Are you ready to have God remove all those defects of character? If you are, you're through with six. Have you humbly asked Him to take them away? If you have, you're through with seven. Now don't make the mistake I did, though. Because I assume that now that I'm ready, all I've got to do is turn to God and say, okay, God, here I am, warts and all. Give me the $29.95 special. Zap me and make me as pure as the driven snow. And I'd never have any problems from that day on. Well, I found out it don't work that way. You know, God will do for me what I can't do for myself. He will not do for me what I can do for myself. I can do nothing about the removal of a character defect other than ask God to take that away. Only He has that power. But I tell you what I can do. If God takes a character defect away, He can't leave a hole in my head. It's got to be filled with something else. And I can go find out what the opposite to that character defect is. And then when any situation comes up that I have the chance to practice the opposite, I can try to be the opposite with God's help. In other words, if I want God to take away selfishness, then at every opportunity I have to try to practice unselfishness. I cannot do that by myself. I need God's help to do so, but God won't do that for me. I have got to do that. If I want God to take away dishonesty, then I've got to start practicing honesty with God's help. If I want God to take away that frightened character I've become, I need to practice courage. I need to kick myself in the butt and make me, with God's help, do things that I was afraid to do before. And just as importantly, make me quit doing some things that I was afraid to quit before. If I want God to take away in consideration, then I've got to start practicing consideration of others with God's help. And I find that my mind is just like my body. My body, over a period of years, has become the product of the things that I have practiced physically. My mind, over the years, has become the product of the things that I have practiced mentally. When I got here, my mind was a set of mental habits practiced over a period of 38 years of time. Now, if I want to break a habit, I've got to work against myself. I can't keep giving in to the old ideas and expect a new idea to take its place. And as God takes one away and I practice the opposite, slowly my mind becomes occupied with a new mental habit. Now today, I am not what I used to be. When I got here, I was a very selfish human being. Today, in most cases, I practice unselfishness. When I got here, I was one of the most dishonest human beings in the world. I would rather lie to you than tell you the truth if the truth had been easier. I'd rather steal from you than go out and make money. Even if making money the other way was easier, I'd still rather steal from you. When I got here, I was one of the most frightened human beings in the world, scared of everything that came down the road. When I got here, there could have been no human being any more inconsiderate of other people than I was. I just didn't give a damn about you. Oh yeah, you could have some, but only after I got everything I wanted first. I'm not that way anymore. Today, I usually, in most cases, I am unselfish. In most cases today, I tell the truth. I can't remember the last time I told a real, real lie. Oh, I tell a little fib once in a while. But I can't remember the last time I stole something from somebody. Well, in most cases today, I have the courage to do things I never could do before. And you know, I've even found the courage to quit doing some things that I thought I had to do. I find today that in most cases I consider other people and their needs and their wants ahead of my own. I have been reborn. Not in my body, but in my mind. I think you and I are the luckiest people in the world. You know, most people out there are sick. And most of them are going to the grave sick, not even knowing they're sick.
Thank you, well.
We not only know we're sick, we know what's wrong with us. We found that in steps 4 and 5. Now we have the tools to change us in 6 and 7. And we can become entirely different human beings. Do you realize that we get to live 2 lifetimes in 1 lifetime? We get to live what we used to be. And now we get to live something entirely different. Most people don't have this opportunity. Now be careful. Because if you buy into this idea, the idea that you can find out what's wrong with you in 4 and 5, the idea that you, with God's help, can change in 6 and 7, then that means from this day on, you are responsible for what you are.
Yeah.
I just can't blame it on her any longer. I can't blame it on God. I can't blame it on Mama. I can't blame it on Daddy. I can no longer play the part of the victim. It's got to be my fault. And it's got to be because that's the way I want to be. Because I don't have to be that way any longer. You know, be careful with this little deal now, because from now on you're responsible.
As Charlie said, these are the changing steps. You know, really, 6 and 7 are real subtle, and where we look at them and don't get a lot of looking at. But they are the changing twos. This is where the job, this is where the action is, this is where we face ourselves, this is where the quality of life exists for us. You know, one, give us 2, and these 2 steps we made a decision on, and the decision removed enough self And then 4 and 5, we identified these things, right? So, you know, all these other 5 steps gave us, put us in a position to change now. So 6 and 7 are the real pinnacle steps. They are the position of change. And as Charlie said, you know, we human beings are simply a product of what we have practiced in the past. Whatever you practice, you become, right? And I was a product of the same pattern of, like everyone else, of bad of mental habits that I had practiced for years. This is who I was. And here I was faced with change. And this is a very difficult thing, but simple but not easy. And I had, you know, and change is real simple. As Charlie said, it's just 2 simple steps. Anybody can make changes. It's hard, but it's simple. Number one, if you want to change, first thing, you don't do what you want to do, right? So if you do what you want to do, you're always feeding actions to those old thoughts, right? So number 6 is don't do what you want to do. And 7 is very difficult. Make yourself do something you don't want to do, right? And we'll, you know, as we find out, if we don't do these old things, we'll slay those things with inactivity. Those old ideas will wither up and die because we don't use them anymore. And as we practice the new tools and we get the benefit of those become our way of thinking. And my book says the old ideas will be cast to one side and a new set of motives begin to dominate us. You know, through not doing and doing. Once we start doing the new things, and I didn't know that too, but it was real shocking. Charlie talks about it. Once I started, I didn't like to be honest. You know, it was a foreign thing to me. But I found out, you know, when I started practicing honesty, my self-esteem went up. I felt better about who I was. You know, when I started practicing courage instead of fear, my self-esteem went up. I didn't have to put up a front anymore. I just naturally felt good about who I was. But I didn't know that because I never have done those things before. You know, as Charlie said, this is a wonderful thing. Changing the body, changing the mind, is a product of what we put into it, like the body is a product of the food we put into it, right? You know, there's a lot of things, everybody's trying to lose weight, and I ain't doing too good on it, but, you know, particularly this weekend, you know, we're getting a problem here, eating too much.
That's all right. We're going to start working on gluttony tomorrow.
No, next week's Thanksgiving. We got to wait another week. Don't come back too quick now. But anyway, you know, if we want to lose, changing the body is the same as changing the mind. By changing the mind, it's the same as changing the body. If you want to lose weight, there's a principle. There's a way to lose weight. Real simple. If you want to lose weight, don't eat what you want to eat.
Hostess, right? Twinkies and pie and cake and ice cream.
And make yourself eat something you don't like.
Lettuce and spinach and broccoli.
Yeah. And I guarantee you will lose weight, right? Same way in our minds, you know. We put in different thoughts, and we don't act out the old thoughts. And our lives have changed. You know, Paul talked about this. I didn't know what he was talking about, really, but he talked about changing, life-changing experience. Principles the same. He said the way we change our lives is daily dying. You know, I thought he wasn't talking about physical. But he was talking about we got to die somewhere in our personalities so we can live somewhere new. And only we can slay ourselves with inactivity. We can slay that with inactivity and new things will take their place. As Charlie said, I think that I feel blessed as an individual to have experienced alcoholism. And given the tools that's been given me, you know, I'm very interested in all kinds of people. And I think I'm very blessed to have an opportunity to have the tools that I have to live better than most people on the face of this earth. You know what I mean? Most people don't know and don't have the opportunity that we have. You know, I always tell them, I say, I hear the preacher always preaching about hell, right? But he's just speculating. He ain't never been there. You know what I mean? Yeah, we know about that, you know. So we deserve. We have an opportunity to be on both sides of the street. We'll probably have the opportunity, as most people say, tonight we'll probably sleep better than most people on the face of this earth. Okay? We take these things for granted. But this is a challenge. This is the opportunity we have. And I think that we deserve it because we paid a price to gain the tools that we've been given.
Listen to this statement now that comes out of the big book. Some of us tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Doesn't that apply here?
Yeah.
Now, out of that other big book that Joe talks about, Listen to this statement. Howsoever a man thinketh, that shall he be. Doesn't that apply here also? Same story. We are responsible for what we put in here. Yeah. And we are responsible for what we let stay in here.
Right.
And it's up to us to do this. We can't do it by ourselves. But God's not going to do it by himself. We must do our part.
Everybody have a good afternoon.
Yeah.
Are you rear ends getting a little sore?
Yeah.
Should be by now, that's for sure. We'll start out with another little joke again, just for the fun of it.
Yeah.
I always like to, about this time of the year, it's getting close to Christmas, and it reminds me of the little young Catholic boy that was about 12 years old, and he went to his dad and asked his dad if there'd be any possibility of him getting a bicycle for Christmas. And his dad said, "Well, son, there's nothing I can do to get you a bicycle. You got a half a dozen brothers and sisters, and I can just barely make a living for the family. Sorry, I can't do anything about it." And the little boy said, "Well, do you have any suggestions at all?" And his dad said, "Well, yeah." He said, "Why don't you write a letter to God and see what would happen? It'd be amazing sometimes what comes out of that." So the little boy, he went to his bedroom after a while and went to his desk and got out a pencil and a piece of paper. And he began to write, and he said, "Dear Jesus," he said, "I'm a little Catholic boy, and I'm 12 years old, and I've never had a bicycle before, and I've always..." "Nah," he said, "hell, that won't work." And he tore that paper up and he threw it away. He sat there for a little while, and he got him another sheet of paper and began to write, and he said, "Dear God," he said, "I'm a little Catholic boy, 12 years old, and I've always done the things I was supposed to do in church and served the best I can, and I've never had a..." He said, "Hell, that won't work." And he tore it up and threw it away. And while sitting there thinking, he happened to look up on his dresser, and there was a little statuette of the Virgin up there. And suddenly his eyes lit up, and he jumped up, and he grabbed that statuette and reached down into his underwear drawer, and he got out a roll of socks. And he unrolled them and put the statuette in the socks, rolled it back up, and very carefully placed it all the way in the back of the underwear drawer and completely covered it up and shut the drawer. And he sat down and he picked up his pencil and a piece of paper and he began to write, and he said, "Dear Jesus, if you ever want to see your mama again..." I bet he turned out to be one of us. What do you bet, huh? We finished up our session earlier today as we finished up with steps 6 and 7. And I think we could all see the value in those steps of being able to look into our minds and see what our problems really are. People, we have always looked at other people to see what their problems were. We've always blamed whatever problems we had on other people. And finally, for the first time in our lives, we looked within our own minds and we could see what our defects were And we could see those things that caused us to continually do things that created problems for other people, that in turn caused them to retaliate against us, which in turn filled us with resentment and fear and guilt and remorse and etc. And as we could see those things, we became willing to do something about their removal. And of course, then we began to work with God in step 7 and doing something about the actual removal of those things. And we found out as they're removed, they would have to be replaced with something else. And those things that replaced those things then actually begin to change us. And we slowly change from selfish into unselfish human beings. We slowly change from dishonest human beings to those that practice a degree of honesty. And we slowly change from a frightened individual to one who has courage. And we slowly change from an inconsiderate human being to a considerate human being. So by now, life is getting pretty good for us. Now, Joe and I, for years, we studied on figuring out how this thing works. And we finally decided it works exactly like step 5 says. That's how it works. I mean, chapter 5 says that's how it works. But then we spent some time looking at the idea of why this thing works. Why does this simple little program that we have in this book take people like us who have become the real outcasts of society in many cases, people who have become absolutely bankrupt in all areas, spiritually, mentally, physically, people like us who have become bankrupt in our relationships with other human beings and with ourselves, and be able to take us and turn us around completely and make us again back into useful members of society? And finally, we saw a statement in the book that said this is a design for living that really works. And we begin to look at that design for living. And we find that the book in a couple places has mentioned the fact that we are tri-dimensional creatures. In other words, we are people who are meant to live with God, with ourselves, and with other human beings. Now, if that's true, and I'm sure it is, and if God dwells within each of us, then we're going to have to live with God whether we like it or not. It's beside the point. We don't have any choice. The only question is, do we live with God in harmony or disharmony? And I don't know of any group of people that ever got in more disharmony with God than we alcoholics did. We hear about this mental dimension, and that means that all of us have a mind. Now, sometimes we act like we don't, but we do. And again, the only question is, do we live with our mind in harmony or disharmony? We don't have any choice. We got to live with it. And I don't know of any group of people that got more fouled up in their minds than we alcoholics have. Then we come to the physical dimension, and for years I thought the physical dimension was my body. But today I realize the physical dimension is the world and everything in it, period. Now, we don't have any place else to live except here on earth. We don't have any choice in that matter. And once again, the only choice is, do we live here in harmony or disharmony? And I don't know of any group of human beings that ever got in more disharmony with the world and everybody in it than we alcoholics had. In other words, we became sick spiritually, mentally, and physically. Now, it looks to us like these first steps that we've been looking at are designed to get us well in those three dimensions and put us back together as God intended for us to be in the first place. In other words, steps 1, 2, and 3, because of our powerless condition, because of the need for the power, we made a decision to go after that power. And steps 1, 2, and 3 got us right with the Spirit. Okay. Steps 1, 2, and 3 got us right with the Spirit. There we made a decision to let God be the director. He's the employer. We are the employee. He is the Father, we are the children. Now that's the first time we had that relationship with God in a long, long time. Always before whatever relationship we had with God, we told Him what we wanted Him to do. God give me this, God give me that, God do this, so on and so forth. So 1, 2, and 3 got us right with God. As we looked into our minds and found our problems, looked at those character defects and began to work on them, and they gradually become less and less, and we start getting right with ourselves through 4, 5, 6, and 7. Now if we want to be complete, whole human beings put back together as God intended, we're going to have to do something about that physical dimension, our relationship with the world and everything in it. Now we worked on resentments, we worked on fear, and as we looked at the people we had harmed, some of our guilt began to disappear. But we've never really done anything yet about this storeroom back here in the back that's filled with guilt and remorse and still some fear associated with what are those people going to do whenever I approach them. So it looks like we're going to have to do something to clean that room out. And then we can be complete human beings again. Now nobody wants to do this. Certainly nobody wants to run out and make apologies to people. Certainly nobody wants to take from today's living expenses money for that to pay back for something that happened years ago. Now the only question becomes is, can we afford not to do this? When we looked at the foreword to the second edition, it sounded like Dr. Bob, after Bill came to see him, that he never had another drink after that time. But that's really not quite true. Dr. Bob had one more drunk left in him. And it wasn't too long after Bill made the initial call on him, Dr. Bob sobered up. It wasn't too long after that that he decided he needed to go to a medical convention over in New Jersey. And his wife, Ann, begged Bill not to let him go. Said, "Bill, don't let him go over there. If he does, he'll get drunk. He does it every year." And Bill said, "Let him go. He's going to have to learn to live in society where there will always be plenty of alcohol. And if he gets drunk, we'll do something about it when he gets back." Well, Dr. Bob went to the medical convention. Sure enough, he got drunk. He comes back to Akron. He shows up at his nurse's home. And she calls Ann and Bill and said, "Come and get him. He's drunk. And by the way, get him sobered up. He's got surgery scheduled early in the morning. And he's the only doctor on staff that can do this particular surgery at the present time." Dr. Bob was a proctologist. I'm glad he wasn't working on my procto the next morning. I know that. They went over and they got him. And they brought him home and they coffeed him and they walked him and they sobered him to the best of their ability. And the next morning, Bill took him to the hospital. And in the parking lot of the hospital, Dr. Bob said to Bill, "I can't do this surgery. I'm sick, I'm shaken, I'm trembling, and I'm going to hurt somebody." And Bill reached in the back seat of the car and got out a bottle of beer, popped the top on it and said, "Drink this and you'll be okay." Dr. Bob drank the beer, went upstairs, did the surgery, and sure enough, it came out just great. Now the only problem is, after the surgery, he disappears. Bill's waiting on him in the parking lot. A couple of hours pass. Bill assumes the beer has triggered the allergy and Bob's off and running again. He goes back to Dr. Bob's house. And he and Ann wait all afternoon. Late evening, Dr. Bob shows up. And he's sober. And Bill said, "Where in the hell have you been?" And he said, "I've been going up and down both sides of the street, making my amends to those I've harmed in the past." And that bottle of beer that Dr. Bob took on June the 10th, 1935, was his last drink and was also AA's birthday. You see, he never would make amends before. He, one thing, he was ashamed of his alcoholism. Another thing was, he assumed that if he made amends, everybody would find out he was an alcoholic and he would lose what little practice he had left. He didn't know that everybody already knew that anyhow. But after he made his amends, it was never necessary for him to drink again. If it's good enough for Bob, it's probably good enough for me. Let's look at this idea for just a little bit. Steps 8 and 9.
Okay, as we begin to go out in this third dimension, as Charlie talked about, we alcoholics are familiar with this third dimension. We have lived in it for years. We have worked in it for years. And we're aware of that. You know, as an alcoholic, this book does give us a design of living, and it's not a new concept in this book. All through every great philosophies and all the great religions and all discussions of human life talk about this same design. There is a design to everything that God created, and there's a design to human life. You know, many great teachers have talked about this. We had a great teacher 2,000 years ago that talked about the same thing. You know, he said, build your house on a firm foundation. He was talking about the spiritual point. He said, love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and all thy soul. That's 1, 2, and 3. And he said, in all thy mind, that's 4, 5, 6, and 7. And he said, and thy neighbor as thyself, that's 8 and 9. So we know this is nothing new. I never knew there was a design to my life. I didn't use it, and this is where I got in trouble. I was interested in the third dimension, okay? You know, I worked hard out there. You know, I let the middle part and the next part go to hell. My mind and my spiritual life went to hell, but I worked on that material section, right? You know, I had a mess out there. You know, I'd lose my job, I'd get my job back, and my wife would be gone. And I'd go get my wife back, and my car would be broke, and I'd get my car fixed, and my wife would be gone. I worked my tail off in the third dimension, but I never did do nothing about the other dimensions of life. You know, the whole time I was doing this, them idiots, you know what they told me out there? You ain't trying. I was trying like hell in the wrong place. What we know, living is an inside job. What we have done is started inside, we're going to work outside. We're going to build our house this time on that firm foundation. So 8 and 9 is talking about putting our lives together. And quite naturally, the same way we work it from the inside out, it collapses from the outside in. If I don't go out and make amends to these people, if I don't clear up my relationship with the world, the people in it, then this is going to back up in my mind and cause me more guilt and remorse and fear. That's going to shut me off from the spirit, and I'm going to drink again. So we can't go, this is the way they say, half measures avail us nothing. If we don't work these steps, we're going to lose the steps we've already worked. We're going to lose the progress we've already gained.
That's why you see so many programs designed for alcoholics that do not work. Because most of the other programs, they concentrate on the outside circle.
That's right.
They say, let's get the alcoholic a job. Let's get them a car. Let's get them a place to live. Let's get their family back together. And then they won't have to drink. And they spend literally millions and millions and millions of dollars doing that for we alcoholics. And no sooner do we get our job back than we get drunk. And then they go get us another job, and then we lose our car, like Joe said. And then go get us another car, and then our wife leaves us. And then we go get us another wife, and then our job's gone again. You see, we didn't start at the right place. AA is an inside job. AA says, let's forget the outside for the time being. Let's start at the middle. And we straighten out our relationship with God first. And that removes enough self-will. Mm-hmm. That lets us then straighten out our relationship with ourselves.
Yeah.
And then that removes enough self-will that now we can go out and straighten out our relationship with the world and everybody in it. You know, we couldn't have done this if we hadn't been using these first 6 steps. We wouldn't have known first half of the people we've even harmed. Because we use resentments to cover all that stuff up, and we didn't even know we'd hurt most of them. Plus, if we haven't been working on 4, 5, 6, and 7, we're still so selfish and dishonest that we're not about to go make amends to anybody. See, these steps are in a perfect sequence to bring about certain things so you can go from one step to another, to another, to another. That's why they have to be worked in sequence. Let's look at 8 and 9 for just a little bit.
Now, on page 76, now we need more action, without which we find faith without works is dead. Let's look at steps 8 and 9. We have a list of persons we have harmed and whom we are willing to make amends. We made it when we took inventory. We have our list all made out and analyzed because we went through the process of step 4. We made out that list. So, actually, half of step 8 is already done. We done that part in step 4 when we made a list. So step 8 says make the list. First, we have already completed that section. That's done. It says, when we took inventory, we have subjected ourselves to drastic self-appraisal. Now we go out to our fellows and repair the damage done in the past. We attempt to sweep away the debris which has accumulated out of the effort to live on self-will and run the show ourselves. So the next thing, if we have the list, the next thing we have to do to complete step 8 is to become willing to make the amends to the people on that list. Step 8 says, make the list. We've done that in 4. Now it says, become willing to make amends. Now Bill, in his talk about this, also says that maybe this may be the key. You know, we're doing this for ourselves. We're doing this to get over the guilt and remorse of the past. You know, we may get our relief when we just become willing to do it. Not when we do it, but willingness may be the key. He goes on to say, if we haven't the will to do this, we ask until it comes. We see a little prayer there in step 8. You know, we this is not a do-it-yourself program. In every step we have prayer. In certain cases, we're not willing to do it. We pray for the willingness until it comes. So that's basically, we have completed step 8. We got a paragraph here on step 8. We make out the list, and then we become willing to the list. You know, we don't even have to, you don't really have to talk to anybody in step 8. And step 8 is so simple to take. It's just, willingness is the key.
Step 8, for me, turned out to be another one of those steps I didn't think I would be able to take. Just like I didn't think I could take step 3. So once again, I had to go back to my sponsor and talk to him about this. And I said, I don't believe I'm going to be able to take steps 8 and 9. And he said, why? And I said, because some of those people that I owe amends to, they have hurt me just as bad as I've ever hurt them. And I'll be damned if I'm going to make any amends to them. And he said, well, now, Charlie, in step 8, you don't have to make any amends. He said, you're getting 8 confused with 9. He said, you make your amends in 9. All you have to do in step 8 is become willing to make those amends. And I said, well, hell, that's just what I'm talking about. I'm not willing to make amends to some of those people that have harmed me because they've hurt me as bad as I ever hurt them. And if I'm not willing to make amends to them all, then I can't take step 8, and if I can't take 8, I can't take 9. He said, well, let me see if I can help you become willing to make amends to them all. He said, you took your step 5 with me, and I pretty well know who's on your list. And he said, I know some of those people. And he said, you love some of those people, and they love you. And he said, I'll bet you that you're willing to make amends to some of those, aren't you? And I said, well, sure I am. I said, there's my mother, there's my father, there's my children. And I really wasn't quite sure about old Barbie yet. We'd put, you know. And he said, okay, what I'd like for you to do, he said, is I'd like for you to get out a sheet of paper. And I'd like for you to put a heading up at the top of it that says, right now. And then I want you to go back and I want you to take all those names off that list that you're willing to make amends to right now and put them on this right now sheet. Can you do that? And I said, well, yeah, I believe I can. He said, okay, go home and do it and then come back. So I went home and I took those names and put them on a right now sheet and I went back to Steve and I said, here's your damn list. Now what do I do? He said, okay, some of these people on this original list, you know and I know that sooner or later you're going to be willing to make amends to them. You're not too keen about it right now, but you know sooner or later you're going to do that. Is that right? And I said, well, yeah. He said, okay, I want you to put a heading on a sheet of paper and call them laters. Take those names off that sheet, put them on this later sheet. Can you do that? I said, well, yeah, I believe I can. So I went home and I took those names off and put them on the later sheet, went back to see him, said, here's your list. What do you want me to do now? He said, there's some of these people on this sheet that you really, really don't know, that you may or may not become willing to make amends to them. Is that right? And I said, yeah. He said, okay, I want you to head it up another sheet and I want you to call it maybe. And I want you to put those names on that maybe sheet. Can you do that? And I said, yeah. He said, go home, do it, and come back. And I did. And he said, now then, all those that are left on the original list, you don't intend to ever make any amends to them. Is that right? And I said, you betcha that's right. He said, let's take another sheet of paper and let's head it up never and put those names on that sheet. Can you do that? And I said, well, yeah, I guess so. And he said, do it and come back. And I did. And he said, now we got four sheets laying here. And he said, I want you to start making amends to the right now list. And he said, I really believe by the time you're through with the right now list, you'll be ready to start working on some of the laters. And he said, I think by the time you're through the later list, you'll probably be ready to start on that maybes list. And he said, now then, I'm going to bet you money. By the time you're through that maybes list, you'll be ready to start on the nevers list. And you know the old fool was exactly right. Rather than let me take four or five names and block myself off from the whole process, he gave me a way by which I could become willing to make amends to them all as I worked the steps themselves. If I'd had to wait till I became willing to make amends to every one of them, I never would have got it done because I just wasn't going to do that. But as I worked my way through the amend sheets, gradually I became willing to make amends to them all. As I made amends and I felt better and better, I was surprised about how the amends were received. A lot of the fear began to disappear. And finally I got to that never sheet and it really did work out. If you got anybody you're working with that's having trouble in this area, try it on them. It actually does work. Now then, step nine. Step nine is one of those multiple part steps, like so many of them are, and there's three distinct parts in it. Step nine tells us the kind of amends to make, direct amends. And then it tells us when to make them, wherever possible. Not whenever possible, but wherever possible. And then it tells us when not to make them, except when to do so would injure them or others. Now, Bill, in his usual manner, has addressed all three of these issues, paragraph by paragraph by paragraph, on the next three or four pages. First, let's look at the idea of direct amends. You know, originally that step said complete amends, and the other members objected to it because it sounded too much like the absolutes. And he called it then direct amends. And we believe there's two kinds of direct amends. One of them is eyeball to eyeball, face to face, one on one. You know, the whole purpose of the making of the amends is not to get you to like me. I hope you do when I'm through. But the whole purpose is for me to get rid of my fear, my guilt, and my remorse associated with that particular situation, whatever it is. If I write you a letter, I'm never quite sure how you received it. I'm still a little bit afraid of what you're going to say the next time I run into you. I'm not sure I've done my utmost. If I call you on the telephone, I got the same situation. But if I go to you wherever you are, your home, your office, or wherever I find you, and I sit down with you and make my amends to you eyeball to eyeball, face to face, one on one, I'll never have to worry about it again. you will have done the worst you're going to do to me right there. And I will have done my utmost right there. And I'll never have to worry about that one anymore. Bill talks about this starting on page 77 in that middle paragraph, about the middle of the paragraph.
Yeah.
He said the question of how to approach the man we hated will arise. Let's look at this direct to men.
Okay. For some reason it's in the middle, new subject in the middle of the paragraph. It may that we he has done us more harm than we have done him, and though we may have acquired a bad attitude toward him, we are still not too keen about admitting our faults. Nevertheless, with a person we dislike, we take the bit in the teeth. It is harder to go to an enemy than to a friend, so it seems like we are going to this person. Okay. But we find it's much more beneficial to us. We go to him in a helpful, giving spirit, confessing our former ill feelings and expressing our regret. Under no condition do we criticize such a person or argue. We simply tell him that we will never give over our drinking until we have done our utmost to straighten out the past. We are there to sweep off our side of the street, realizing that nothing worthwhile can be accomplished until we do so, never trying to tell him what he should do. His faults are not discussed. We stick to our own. If our manner is calm, frank, and open, we'd be gratified with the results. In 9 cases out of 10, the unexpected happens. Sometimes the man we are calling upon admits his own faults, so feuds of years standing melt away in an hour. Rarely do we fail to make satisfactory progress. Our former enemies sometimes praise what we are doing and wish us well. Occasionally, they will offer assistance. It should not matter, however, if someone does throw us out of his office. We have made our demonstration, done our part. It's water over the dam. You know, Bill always tells us, when he gives us something, then he gives us an illustration of what he's talking about. And here we see a real illustration of going to a person face to face, making a direct amend, a direct face to face amend. This is one type of direct amend.
If this would work for somebody you hated, well, then probably it would work on those who just kind of dislike them. Face to face, one on one. This guy that I hated so badly, that I asked God to give that SOB everything that he deserved. When I finally got into the amend stage of the recovery, I began to realize that I owe that guy some amends. Now, it certainly does not excuse what he did to me, but I did some things that put him in a position to allow him to be able to do that to me. I made some decisions based on self. You know, what actually happened, he and I had gone into a little partnership thing. And one day he just up and ran off and absconded with the funds and infuriated the living hell out of me. And for a long, long time, I couldn't see that I owed him any amends. But finally, I began to realize that one day I made a decision based on self. He didn't come to me in the first place. I went to him. He had something that I needed. He had some money and he had some extra expertise that I didn't have. And I conned him into the little partnership. And then later on, he absconded with the funds. But he couldn't have done that if I hadn't been going to him in the first place for my own selfish reasons. When I went to see him, I wasn't concerned with how much money he was going to make. I was concerned with what I could get from him to help me make some money. So I felt that I owe this guy some amends. And I went to him and I sat down with him, eyeball to eyeball, face to face, next door neighbor by now. And I began to make my amends. And about halfway through, he did exactly what this book said. He said, whoop, 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 wait, stop, hold on. He said, "Man, I've been wanting to make some apologies to you for a long, long time." And he said, "I want you to know that I'm sorry for what I did. Would you forgive me?" And that whole thing just melted away just like that. And I'm so glad it did, because it wasn't very long after that that this guy passed away with an unexpected heart attack. And I'm glad I got it over with before that took place. This thing really does work now. Just simple little things that will work out for us every time if we'll try it. How about another kind of direct amend?
Yeah.
How about one that involves material things?
Direct proportion.
You know, a casual apology don't always work when it comes to material things. Wouldn't even much good to come to see you and say, "Look, when I was drinking, I stole $800 from you. I'm sorry. Would you forgive me?" You're probably going to say, "I'm sorry too. Where's my $800? Equal proportion. Bill handles that in the very next paragraph. He said, "Most alcoholics owe money." Though I believe that's the understatement of the year, isn't it? Many of us run up hot checks we didn't pick up. We ran up bills at different stores and places we never did pay. We borrowed money we never did give back. We stole automobiles that we never did return. We tore up automobiles that we never did fix. And we hurt many, many people in the material world. What are we going to do about that? You know, we're still guilty there too, and we feel it. Whether they know it or not is beside the point. We know it. He said, "We do not dodge our creditors. Tell them what we're trying to do. We make no bones about our drinking. They usually know it anyway, whether we think so or not. Nor are we afraid of disclosing our alcoholism on a theory it may cause financial harm. Approached in this way, the most ruthless creditor will sometimes surprise us. Arranging the best deal we can, we let these people know we are sorry. Our drinking has made us slow to pay. We must lose our fear of creditors no matter how far we have to go, for we're liable to drink if we're afraid to face them." Now, I think what Bill is saying is this. That if I owe you some money and I can't pay you, what I'd really like to do now is wait till I get it all together in one lump sum and put it in a paper sack and walk in your office and slam it down on your desk and say, "Here's your money." But I'm probably not going to be able to do that. I think what he's saying is, if I owe you some money, I need to come to you. And I need to say to you, "Look, I owe you $800 and I know it and you know it too. And I don't have the money to pay you today. But I would like to start paying you $5 a week, $10 a week, or whatever it is that I feel that I can afford to pay and still halfway comfortably live with that. And then I start paying you that $5 a week. And as the weeks go by and I pay you $5 each week, the debt becomes less and less. And some morning I wake up and I say in my mind, 'Hey, by golly, that sucker's paid off. I don't have to worry about that one anymore.' And then I go to the next one. And I say, 'Look, you and I both know I owe you $1,200. Can't pay you today. But I'd like to start paying you $10 a week.' And as the weeks go by, I pay you $10 a week. The debt becomes less and less. Some morning I wake up and I say, 'Hey, that one's paid off too.' And then I go to the next one. And then the next one, and then the next one, and some morning I wake up, and I find that I'm able to say, 'I don't owe anything to anybody.' Now, I've lived long enough to know one thing for sure. Time is going to pass. God, I wish I could stop it, but I can't. And as time passes, I've got the choice of using that time for a useful purpose, or just let it slip by and slip by and slip by, and 4, 5, 6, 8, 10 years from now, still owe every one of them, still worried about it, still guilty about it, and maybe drunk in the meantime. This is a very definite, valuable suggestion on how we can pay some of those off.